And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Robert Lacey, a British historian and author of numerous international bestsellers, among them Majesty, a biography of Queen Elizabeth II, The Kingdom, a study of Saudi Arabia, published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machines, and Great Tales from English History. His other books include biographies of the gangster Meyer Lansky, Princess Grace of Monaco, and a study of Sotheby's Auction House. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia, a modern history of the Saudis, in their own words, revealing a people attempting to reconcile life under religious law with the demands of a rapidly changing world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lacey.
Thank you, Ian, very much.
And clearly, with the death of the Crown Prince and the likely secession of Prince Nayef, many commentators are looking at Saudi Arabia and seeing comparisons with the gerontocracy in the Kremlin towards the ends of the Soviet Empire.
Well, that's certainly true in terms of age. It's not perhaps taking full account of the culture of Saudi Arabia. I was just talking to somebody the other day and realizing that something that Saudi Arabia doesn't have, and with its economy it has just about everything it wants, is old people's homes, because all old people live at home and they are treated as the head of the household with great respect until the day they die. I've got an incredibly wealthy, powerful, successful Saudi businessman friend who is not traveling at the moment because his father, who is frankly out of it mentally, is ill, and he wouldn't dream of leaving him. So to switch to the royal family in your implied question, that is how they operate. And Crown Prince Sultan, who's just died, probably in his mid-80s, is now being succeeded almost certainly as Crown Prince by his brother Nayef, the interior minister, aged about 78, 79, not in the best of health. The king has just had a second back operation in the course of a year and is not in great health. But the whole system revolves around reverence for age. And just one other comparison with what you're talking about, Russia. Saudi Arabia is incredibly wealthy. Why are we in the West poor at the moment? To oversimplify, it's because we pay too much for our energy. For heating our homes, for running our cars or everything, where is that money? It's in Saudi Arabia. When the Arab Spring happened earlier this year, the king doubled the budget. He paid out, I think, $150 billion. All civil servants got an extra month's salary, just like that. They've got the money, and so long as that's the case, there's a lot going for the House of Saud.
Again, I'm speaking with British historian and author Robert Lacey, the author of Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. But these young women that you mention, princesses, studying at Georgetown, surely it's schizophrenic if you get a Western education and live the way that we live. And that seems to be universal in the Arab world, particularly this Arab Spring. It's the young people want to live fairly secular and modern lives. And more importantly, the refrain that you hear from the Arab Spring is, we want dignity. We're sick of either kings or dictators and their cronies stealing us blind, and we want our share of the future. So why should it be different? In other words, it seems to me that we're talking about an absolute monarchy, which is in itself almost extinct on the face of the earth, no parliament, nothing except the largesse of the leader, compared to this tectonic shift that's taking place amongst this young generation. And after all, in most Arab countries, the young are up to 50-60% of the population.
Yes, those are all good points, Ian. But as I've already said, one of the big differences between Saudi Arabia and the countries you've mentioned is just the sheer wealth. It's very interesting. The Arab Spring has affected republics. It has not affected the monarchies. We're not just talking Saudi Arabia here. We're talking about all the Gulf monarchies. We're talking about Jordan. We're talking about Morocco. These countries, well, Morocco and Jordan are not so wealthy, but to switch into a social mode, the Arab monarchies are very tribal systems. They are linked into the tribes. Their armed forces come from the tribes. And that means that in every tribe, in every village, in every community, you've got a head of the tribe who looks for allegiance higher up the chain and higher up the chain to the king. So you've got social networks in these tribal monarchies that you don't have in the republics where there's been such trouble and where, incidentally, they don't seem to have got much further for the revolutions that they've brought forward. Secondly, there is the point of the wealth in Saudi Arabia. A third and most important point, which is unique to Saudi Arabia, is that the king calls himself custodian of the two holy places. The royal family, and indeed the whole of Saudi Arabia, are immensely proud of the fact that 5 million or more pilgrims come to Saudi Arabia every year, that all around the world, the millions of Muslims in the world pray to Mecca and Medina. And therefore, that is not just actually a source of prestige and wealth to some degree when the pilgrims come. It's a matter of spiritual blessing that they look after the holy sites of Islam. It gives them credit in heaven. So it's tremendously important for them to maintain the traditional ways of life. And if you want to be cynical about it, it's very dangerous for them to get too radical or too liberal or too, you know, different. There are many, many traditional imams around the world who don't agree with democracy, who don't agree with equal rights for women. Now, that's the constituency that Saudi Arabia has to take account of as well.
Well, in terms of the Saudi peace initiative, which the Israelis gave the back of the hand to, as did the Americans, who supposedly are the honest brokers, recently the former retiring head of Mossad castigated the Israeli right for not taking up that opportunity because things are shifting. You've mentioned the showdown now between the Saudis and the other Sunni kings and the Iranians this plot, of course, the target of this plot, and it is a little hard to believe, but the target of the plot is a favorite of the king's, the Saudi ambassador to Washington. He's the fellow that apparently said that we have to cut off the head of the snake, meaning the Iranians. According to the Saudis, the Iranians were trying to destabilize Bahrain. That's why they invaded. So I think you could make the case, surely, Robert Lacey, that there's something of a surrogate war going on there already.
I think you're right. I myself, although, you know, quite pro-Saudi in some ways, didn't really buy what happened in Bahrain. I mean, it was crude realpolitik to go in there. I mean, the basic problem in Bahrain for the Saudis and for America, which has an enormous naval base there, is that really, the Sunnis are in a minority and the Shia in a majority. And were the proper rules of democracy to apply in Bahrain, you'd have the Shia winning the election. And from the little I know about Bahrain, it's really that enormous sense of injustice that's driving the trouble there. The Iranians don't need to interfere because there is this sense of blatant injustice, which has been perpetuated now by the Saudi invasion. And, of course, America turns a blind eye to it.
Well, actually, the U.S. and Robert Gates and others were critical of the Saudis and wished they would have encouraged the king to modernize and to liberalize and accept these, give some rights to the Shiite majority. I think the U.S., they may have turned a blind eye, but they at least went on the record saying that they thought that this heavy-handed military response was the wrong way to go.
Yes, well, we may have to differ on that one, Ian. I mean, went on the record, but kept the American warships in a nice harbor.
At the end of the day, that's probably what it's all about. I wouldn't doubt that for a minute. But just in closing, though, Robert Lacey, it seems to me that things are on a kind of collision course. You get the distinct feeling that Syria being an example where the Iranians on the one hand are propping up the murderous Assad clan, giving them some serious money and logistical help through the IRGC. And on the other hand, the Saudis are calling for the overthrow of the Assads. I'm sure there's some serious behind-the-scenes activities going on in both cases. Where is it going to lead to, do you think?
You put your finger in on a very interesting area that people don't know enough about. But I think in terms of the big Middle Eastern power play, Syria is the sort of pawn, the arena that the two sides really want. And, of course, it has enormous implications for Israel as well, even if Israel's a bit of a spectator. One of the things people don't realize is, for example, that King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia comes from the Shammah tribe, who are an enormous tribe going across the middle of Arabia and into Syria. And this is one of the reasons why he has come out very fiercely in condemning the regime there.
Which is an Alawite Shia regime, right?
It is. It is. I mean, strangely, the king had, perfectly good relationship with the young president of Syria. I remember seeing them together about 2 years ago when he came down to Riyadh, and he was, obviously getting on very well personally with the king. But when it comes to A, the Shia, and B, Iran, a Sunni monarchy like Saudi Arabia is absolutely unmovable and unapologetic and will not give way at all, or, as we saw with Bahrain, won't hesitate to go in and crush the opposition no matter what we in the West complain about.
Well, Robert Lacey, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with British historian and author Robert Lacey. He's the author of a number of bestsellers, including Majesty, Biography of Queen Elizabeth II, The Kingdom of Study of Saudi Arabia, published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from English History. His other books include biographies of the gangster Meyer Lansky, Princess Grace of Monaco, and the study of Sotheby's Auction House. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can also sign up for podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.